Hello, my name is Steve Carlisle from Clearly Training, and this is the second of our current podcasts on auditing. The first podcast covered the regulation of UK auditing, and this podcast is going to look at recent changes to international standards on auditing. Now, if you listen to the first podcast, you'll know there was a big shake-up in 2004 when the UK adopted all of the international standards on auditing. And you may also remember, if you listen to that podcast, if not, I'll remind you that our UK version of the international standards on auditing has sections in grey shaded boxes where the ISA is supplemented for UK additions. That might be, for example, where UK legislation requires the UK auditor to do something extra than is required in the international standard on auditing. Now, I've picked the period from 2006 to 2009 to look at updates that have happened recently. That's my version of recent, 2006 through to 2009, so 4 years in effect. The standards I'm going to look at are as follows. They cover seven different areas. Six of them are changes to standards. The seventh area deals with the Clarity Project. And if you have listened to our first audit podcast, that information on the Clarity Project is also repeated in that first project. So the areas are as follows. Number one, I'm going to look at the International Standard on Quality Control, ISQC1, as it's known. Secondly, I'm going to look at International Standard on Auditing 200 on objectives and general principles of auditing. Thirdly, I'm going to look at International Standard on Auditing number 230, which is on audit documentation. Fascinating stuff. Fourthly, I'm going to look at International Standard 720 on other information and the director's report. That's other information that the auditor doesn't audit, and the director's report and what the auditor's responsibilities are there. Next, I'm going to look at International Standard on Auditing number 600, which deals with using the work of another auditor. And then I'm going to look at International Standard on Auditing number 700, which deals with the audit report. And finally, I'm going to look, as I said earlier, at the Clarity Project. Okay, so let's start with the International Standard on Quality Control, ISQC1. What's the purpose of this standard? Why does it exist? Well, it's there to make sure that the audit firm has principles of quality control running through the whole firm, not just while it's conducting the audit, but all of the time. And there are certain key principles embodied within that quality control standard. First of all, what about leadership? Each audit organisation has to have strong leadership, and leadership that promotes and supports the quality control standards within the organisation. It would be no good having an organisation where all of the staff were expected to comply with quality control guidance and the people at the top weren't. So it's do as I do rather than do as I say. Next, we have the fact that each firm has to have its own ethical requirements. Now, if you've listened to our first podcast, or even if you haven't, there are ethical standards that are required of all auditors. Each firm will then create its own set of ethical standards. So it may have ethical standards relating to relationships that the firm staff have with the client staff. And your own internal requirements may actually go beyond the scope of the basic ethical standards in the APB guidance. Next, we have rules on acceptance and continuation of client relationships. So what procedures do we have to go through to accept client relationships, and how long should we continue with the same client? There are rules in the ethical standard that tell us what the tipping point is for when we might be considered to have a too close a relationship with the client. But the firm's rules might be even stronger than those in the basic ethical standards. Then we have rules for human resources. that would be in terms of how we recruit and train our members of staff. And next we have rules on engagement performance. Do we have our own internal working as to how we go about performing an engagement? And lastly, the firm should have rules for monitoring. That's monitoring its own audits. It may have its own internal auditors who monitor the work of the audit team. I'm going to give you a little example now that you might like to think about. Have a listen to this. You might want to turn the podcast off after you've heard it and think about it for a few moments, then turn the podcast back on and I'll talk you through an outline solution. So here's an example. Let's say your firm have been approached by Dawkins Precision Components PLC to provide audit services. You might be very excited about that, might be a really big client. Let's say the company has 5 sites located around the UK and a further 2 sites in Asia. They have made losses in each of the previous 3 years. And in 2007, you wouldn't believe this, the chief executive was imprisoned for fraud. He's now out and he's back being chief executive. They have had 3 different auditors in the previous 5 years. So you will be the 4th auditor. Which aspects of the quality control standard need to be considered here? As I said, you might like to turn the podcast off for a few moments and think about it. And when you turn back on, I'll talk you through the solution. Okay, so the easy answer to that question is all of them. Every single one of those principles needs to be thought about. Let's just think about them ourselves. What about leadership? You have to have strong leadership within the audit firm. If you're going to take on this client, you've just been told in the question that the chief executive of the client was imprisoned for fraud. You're going to have to make sure that your leadership within your organisation, your engagement partner, for example, has the strength of character to be able to deal with this situation. Your firm has to have its own ethical requirements. You may, for example, have rules that would stop you from dealing with this type of client, a client where the chief executive had recently been released from prison after serving a sentence for fraud. You will certainly have rules on acceptance of engagements and the procedure that you need to go through. For example, you would communicate with those previous auditors, certainly the auditor who was there before you took over. In terms of human resources, you'd have to make sure that you had the personnel to be able to carry out the work. Now, we said that 2 of the sites are located over in Asia. They may be significant. They may have material balances in them. And we may need to go over there and audit those sites over in Asia. Do we have the human resources? Do we have the language skills to be able to do that? In terms of engagement performance, again, the fact that we have sites all around the UK and sites in Asia as well would mean that we'll have to consider how logically we're going to go about visiting all of those different sites. And finally, on monitoring, the quality of the work will need to be overseen and we'll need to follow the procedures of the firm in monitoring that audit. So basically, on that particular assignment, a rather unusual one, all of those principles will come into play. But in fact, they'll probably come into play in every assignment that you undertake as an auditor. The next standard, International Standard on Auditing number 200. This one deals with the objectives and general principles of auditing. So first of all, what is the objective of an audit? Well, the standard says the objective of an audit is to express an opinion. In terms of the general principles, the auditor has to comply with the code of ethics. The code of ethics that we have in the United Kingdom is issued by the Auditing Practices Board. And if you're interested, this is mentioned on our first podcast on auditing. Thirdly, the auditor should use professional scepticism. What's professional scepticism? Well, it means that we accept information only after we've scrutinised it and confirmed it ourselves. We don't take anything at its face value. Next, we should use international standards on auditing, the law and any other regulation when we're carrying out our audit. We should also look for reasonable assurance when we're carrying out our audit work, as opposed to absolute assurance, which may in some cases not be possible to attain. so we should look for reasonable assurance only. We should only be concerned with material items when we're carrying out our audit work, and that is that we should be concerned with items that are significant to our audit report. Now, ISO 200 talks about the idea of audit risk. And it tells us that audit risk is the risk that the auditor will reach the wrong conclusion on the audit. You might think that audit risk is the risk that there's an error in the accounts. Well, it's not. Because if there's an error in the accounts and the auditor spots it, then the auditor has carried out his work properly. So the risk for the auditor is basically that he doesn't spot the error. He reaches the wrong conclusion. Now, why do we get that audit risk? Well, the standard says that the audit risk is made up of three separate risks. Those risks are as follows. First of all, there's the risk that errors will arise in the client in the first place. This is known as inherent risk. Each client is inherently risky, and some clients are more inherently risky than others. You know, if you think about it, a business that has lots and lots of cash transactions is going to be inherently risky in terms of the amount of cash going through the tills and the likelihood of that cash being lost or stolen. A business with a new management team is going to be more inherently risky than a business with an experienced management team. Every business is inherently risky. The second risk we have is control risk. Now, some clients, not all of them, but some clients will have control systems. The control systems will be there to catch the inherent risks, to stop those inherent risks actually getting into the accounts. So the control risk is the risk that the internal control system doesn't stop errors getting into the financial statements. So that control risk could be two things, couldn't it? It could be the fact that there's no control there in the first place, because if there's no control, the error's going to get through. Or it could be that the control that does exist isn't very good and that the error gets through anyway. So that's control risk. So we've got inherent risk and control risk. The third risk is the risk that the auditor doesn't spot the errors. And this is called detection risk. You know, at the end of the day, if the business is extremely risky, if it's got lots of inherent risk, if it's got no real control system and tons of errors end up in the financial statements, as long as the auditor spots that, then he'll come to the right conclusion. So the detection risk is the risk that the auditor misses these errors that have got through into the financial statements and reaches the wrong conclusion. And what the auditor wants to do on his audit is to make sure that he reduces the level of risk that he has as an auditor. Okay, so that's ISO 200 dealing with the objectives and general principles of the audit. Let's have a look now at ISO number 230 on documentation. What's this one about? Well, it's about the documentation and the quality of the documents that need to be kept when you perform your audit. It sounds a little bit bland, this one, doesn't it? Well, yes, it does, but it's very important. It's very important that you have the documentation that allows other people to scrutinise your work and make sure you've done your work properly. At the end of the day, the auditor doesn't want to leave themselves open to allegations that they haven't carried out their work properly and professionally. So what are the rules on documentation? Well, first of all, the standard states that the documentation must provide sufficient and appropriate record of the basis for the report that the auditor is making. Secondly, that the documentation provides evidence of compliance with ISAs, with regulation, and with legislation. And lastly, and this is the key thing, this is the most important bit, that the documentation is sufficient to allow an experienced, unconnected auditor to understand what you've done. That's interesting, isn't it? It's not saying that your documentation has to be good enough for a layperson to understand. Your documentation simply has to be good enough to allow an experienced but unconnected auditor to understand the work that you've done. Okay, ISO 230 has a further list of detailed requirements for your documentation. Here it is. The documentation must specify which items have been tested. So, for example, if you've tested a series of invoices, you give the invoice numbers of the selected items. Next, you must document discussions on significant items. You must identify the preparers and reviewers of the documentation and give dates that the documentation was both prepared and reviewed. The file itself must be assembled on a timely basis. The preference would be that your document is assembled as you go through the audit. Once you finish the audit, the file must be kept for a minimum period of 5 years. And lastly, your file, in general terms, must not be added to and must not have parts deleted after it has been completed. And that's ISA 230 on audit documentation. Moving on then, ISA 720, other information in audited financial statements and the director's report. What's this one about? Well, the concern here is that when we do our audit, we're auditing certain parts of the document called the annual report. In essence, those parts of the annual report that we are auditing are the financial statements together with the notes on the financial statements. So what this standard looks at is, well, what if there is other information alongside those financial statements? That other information might, for example, be a chairman's report. And also, what about the director's report? Because the director's report is actually a statutory requirement. All companies will issue a director's report. And what if that other information and or the director's report gave a different view of the company's performance to the actual financial statements that the auditor is auditing? It'd be no good if the auditor said, yeah, the financial statements are great, they give a true and fair view and so on. And on the other hand, you then had a director's report which gave a completely different view of the company. That would leave the user of the accounts extremely confused. The auditor's saying, on the one hand, yes, the financial statements are okay, but the financial statements are giving a different picture to the director's report. How does the auditor cope with this? Well, that's what 720 is all about. So let me tell you about 720. 720 was issued in April 2006. And it's basically split into two bits. Part A is concerned with that other information, which could be anything else that's issued alongside the audit report. Part B refers to the newly introduced rules in the Companies Act, which require the audit report to state whether, in the auditor's opinion, the director's report is consistent with the financial statements. So the director's report is slightly different to any other information in that the auditor actually has to refer to it in his audit report. So I'm going to do that in two bits as well. Part A then, other information. So the rules on other information are as follows. First of all, what actually is other information? I've mentioned a chairman's statement could be counted as other information. Also, organisations are issuing something called an operating and financial review alongside their financial statements, which will give a narrative view of how the company has performed in the year. There may also be information relating to the corporate governance procedures that the company has to carry out that is issued alongside the financial information. Now, first of all, if that information is completely and utterly consistent with the financial statements, the auditor doesn't have a problem. But what about where that information is inconsistent? Well, where it's inconsistent, the first thing the auditor does is to try and resolve it. You know, it goes up to the company and says, well, you know, why is this difference there? Could you perhaps change that information so it becomes consistent? So that's your first port of call. The auditor can even ask the client to consult a third party if it's a technical issue that the client is unsure of. If, however, that inconsistency remains, then there are two potential outcomes. The first one is that the other information is right and the financial statements are actually wrong. Now, that's quite unlikely, isn't it? Because at this stage, the auditor will have finished his work and he will have given his opinion on the financial statements. So that's quite unlikely. But if it does happen, then what the auditor has to consider is whether or not he should qualify the financial statements. The alternative outcome, and the more likely one, is that it's the other information that's wrong. And the auditor's only real recourse there is an emphasis of matter paragraph, where he puts a paragraph into the audit report to point out to the shareholder or other user of the financial statements that this other information is incorrect. I must mention here that this emphasis of matter paragraph is not a qualification in the audit report. It doesn't count as a qualification in the audit report. Part B of this standard covers the director's report itself. So the auditor has a specific duty now in the Companies Act to report, to specifically say whether or not the director's report is consistent with the financial statements. And of course, most of the time, the director's report will be consistent with the financial statements. But what if it's not? Well, similar procedure to that mentioned before. First of all, the auditor must seek to resolve any inconsistencies. So basically, to ask the directors to change their director's report. But if they insist on keeping the director's report as it is, then again, there are two possible outcomes. And as I said, on the other information, the least likely of those is that it's the financial statements that are wrong. Unlikely, because the auditor will have finished his work at this stage and should know whether or not the financial statements are wrong. The more likely outcome is that it's the director's report that's wrong. So if the director's report is wrong, what does the auditor do? Well, the auditor puts a special paragraph in his audit report. And this is what it would be like. This is how the audit report would look. First of all, the opinion section of the audit report would not, I repeat, not be qualified. What the auditor would then do is he would put a separate headed paragraph as follows. He'd put the heading, Material Inconsistency Between the Financial Statements and the Director's Report. So again, he'd put the heading, Material Inconsistency Between the Financial Statements and the Director's Report. And here's an example of what one might sound like that I've made up. The director's report states that the company's turnover grew by 20% during the year. The financial statements show that the actual rate of growth was 16%. Except for this matter, in our opinion, the information given in the director's report is consistent with the financial statements. So that's ISA 720, looking at other information issued alongside the financial statements and also looking at the auditor's requirements in respect of the director's report. So let's have a look at ISA 600, using the work of another auditor. Now, this standard looks at the situation where we have an auditor who is auditing a holding company. That auditor is known as the principal auditor. And that holding company has subsidiaries, some of which are audited by the principal auditor, and some of which are audited by other auditors. So, for example, we might have a holding company audited by the principal auditor, a UK subsidiary audited by the principal auditor, another UK subsidiary audited by another auditor, and we could even have a third subsidiary audited by a foreign auditor. That subsidiary itself may very well be foreign. The concern for the principal auditor is, number one, how material are the two subsidiaries that the principal auditor doesn't audit? And number two, what is the competence level of the two auditors that are auditing those two subsidiaries? And if you looked at that example, if you thought about that example, you would say, well, for the UK subsidiary that's audited by another UK auditor, we should be reasonably confident that they're working to the same standards that we are, because they must be authorised by a recognised supervisory body like we are. And for that foreign subsidiary that's audited by a foreign auditor, we would have a little bit more concern, because we don't know what standards those auditors are working to. We'd have a little bit more comfort if they were working in the European Union, because we would know that they were working to the ISAs, the same as we were working to. But if it was outside the European Union, we'd have more concern still. So let's have a look at the detailed rules. The basic principles are as follows. The principal auditor is responsible for the audit of the group and makes no reference at all to other auditors when he does his audit report. You can't say in your audit report, well, we've done the audit, but we didn't do all of it. Some of it was done by somebody else, and, you know, if things are wrong, it's their fault. You can't say that. You're responsible for the whole lot. It's you, as principal auditor, that's responsible for the audit of the whole group. And your audit report must be silent on the fact that any other auditors are involved. So the principal auditor needs to consider the competence of the other auditor. The principal auditor also has to consider the resources of the other auditor. Are those resources sufficient for that other auditor to be able to undertake the audit work correctly? The principal auditor needs to perform procedures to ensure it has sufficient reliable evidence that the other auditor's work is sufficient. And lastly, the other auditor has a duty to cooperate with the principal auditor. So that's good for the principal auditor. They know that the other auditor should cooperate with their requests. So when the principal auditor looks at the work of the other auditor, these are the things that the principal auditor would want to consider. The principal auditor would want to consider the significant findings of the other auditor, and obviously would want to consider how significant or material they were in the context of the group audit. The principal auditor will document any review that he undertakes of the other auditor's work. And where the principal auditor thinks that the other auditor can't be relied upon and the principal auditor can't do alternative work, then the choices the principal auditor will have, unfortunately, will either be to qualify on the grounds perhaps of disagreement, or perhaps to give a disclaimer due to a limitation in scope of his audit work. What we're saying there with that last point is that sometimes the principal auditor, even if they don't really want to rely on the work of the other auditor, may be able to carry out their own procedures in the work that they do with the holding company or with the other subsidiaries. He may be able to carry out sufficient work to give himself certainty as to the items covered by the other auditor. If he can't, then his options, as I mentioned, are to qualify or to give a disclaimer due to limitation in scope. Okay, so that was ISA 720, relying on the work of other auditors. And the key problem there is what happens when we're in a group situation and one of the other auditors is auditing a material subsidiary and we can't get assurances to the quality of their work. Right, let's have a look at ISA 700 on audit reports. There was a discussion paper called Promoting Audit Quality, and the Auditing Practices Board looked at the feedback that demanded changes to how the audit report was laid out. The Auditing Practices Board issued a paper called The Auditor's Report, A Time for Change, and the Auditing Practices Board considered the responses in creating its new version of ISA 700. So what were the changes made? Let me give you a summary. First of all, the length of the auditor's report was reduced. Secondly, the standard was written so that we could move towards global convergence by requiring the auditor's opinion on the financial statements to be separate from other opinions required by law and regulation. The two-part opinion is a feature of ISA 700 as issued by the International Board. And lastly, the standard facilitates the inclusion of additional comments in the auditor's report. So, the specific changes that we made. First of all, the basis of opinion paragraph, as it used to be called, is now called the scope of the audit paragraph. And there are three different alternatives to presenting that scope of the audit paragraph. They're as follows. Number one, you can cross-refer to a statement of the scope of an audit section on the APB website. So basically, you don't have to write the words out in your audit report. You simply cross-refer and say the scope of the audit is covered on the APB's website. The second option is to cross-refer to a statement of the scope of the audit elsewhere in the annual report. That option would seem to be a little bit of a waste of time. Why would you do that rather than put it in the report itself? Because that's the third option. Third option is that you describe the scope of the audit actually in the audit report itself. If you did that, there wouldn't be any change to what we've done in the past, really. So the key change, the key improvement here, is that the APB are hoping, I suppose, that you will simply have a paragraph that just cross-refers to the APB website. Anybody who hasn't seen that scope of the audit paragraph before can go to the APB website, but most users of the accounts will have seen it year on year. Another important change relates to the description of the auditor's responsibilities. This has been both reduced in length and in part redistributed to the second part of the auditor's report that addresses other reporting matters. This new standard applies to periods ending on or after the 5th of April 2009. So it's currently in play for those with a year end of December 2009. Some other interesting points. First of all, the APB's version of ISA 700 is different from the International Standard on Auditing number 700. The Auditing Practices Board is keeping this under review as it wants to play a part in influencing the development of that international standard going forward. But I must emphasise that our version of ISA 700, that's the UK version, is different to the international version. I want to talk just for a moment about the international version of this standard, because it is slightly different in the terminology to the UK version. The international version of the standard refers to modified and unmodified audit reports, whereas we refer to qualified and unqualified in the UK. An unmodified audit report means a totally unchanged audit report, whereas a modified audit report means a report with no qualifications and no emphasis of matter paragraph. And it's that last point there that where the difference lies. If we have an emphasis of matter paragraph in the UK, we would still call that an unqualified audit report. Brief recap of the different qualifications now we can have in the UK. So I'm back to the UK version of ISA 700 now. And there are two basic qualifications that we can have. And those qualifications can be at two different levels. So first of all, we have the limitation of scope qualification. This is where the auditor is unable to carry out procedures due to lack of evidence. So an example of that might be where accounting records are lost or destroyed. Now, the auditor here isn't saying that there's definitely something wrong with the financial statements. It's just the fact that he doesn't know whether there is anything wrong or not, because the information is missing. So a material qualification for limitation of scope might read something like this: except for any adjustments that might be necessary, the financial statements give a true and fair view. The other level of qualification for a limitation of scope is the pervasive qualification. Now, this is where the missing information is so significant that it renders the whole of the financial statements unreliable. So it's not just one area that there's a problem with, it's several areas. And the sort of language the auditor would use here in this qualification is the auditor would say he was unable to form an opinion. This is known as a disclaimer. So we've covered the limitation of scope qualification at the two different levels. The other qualification is the disagreement qualification. Now here, the auditor is disagreeing with a treatment of an item or perhaps disagreeing with a fact. So, for example, the auditor might be disagreeing that a debt should be provided for. The client has said that the debt is good. The auditor thinks it's a bad debt. Here, for a material level of qualification, the auditor would use language such as except for the provision of the bad debt, the financial statements give a true and fair view. So the auditor is just concerned about that one material item. The next level of qualification, though, is the pervasive qualification. And here, like last time, the auditor would be given a pervasive qualification because the whole of the financial statements are unreliable, because perhaps the error is individually so big that it affects the reliability of the underlying financial statements, or it could be because there are several errors. And here, the auditor would give what's called an adverse opinion and would say the financial statements do not give a true and fair view. So they're the two basic qualifications, a limitation of scope and disagreement at the two levels, material and pervasive. We've also got to think about inherent uncertainties. What's an inherent uncertainty? Well, an inherent uncertainty is where there is insufficient information available because the matter under review will only be resolved in the future. What's an example of that then? Well, an example might be that the bank is considering renewing your overdraft facilities and the bank manager hasn't made up their mind yet. So if your facilities were renewed, then the company would be able to continue in its operational existence. And if they weren't, then the company might become insolvent. Because this hasn't been decided yet, the auditor can't say whether the financial statements are true and fair on a going concern basis or not. What does the auditor do about this then? It's not that there's missing information in terms of the information has been lost. It's that there is information that we just won't know until some point in the future. Well, what the auditor does is this. The auditor looks to see whether the uncertainty is properly disclosed in the financial statements. And if it is, if there is full and frank disclosure on that item, then the auditor will include an explanatory paragraph in his audit report detailing the item under review and why it's an inherent uncertainty and the fact that it's been properly disclosed in the accounts. And then after that, the auditor gives a clean audit report. The auditor does not qualify his opinion in that situation. The alternative outcome is that the matter hasn't been properly disclosed. And if that's the case, then the auditor will qualify his audit report and he will qualify it for disagreement, because what the auditor is doing is disagreeing with the level of disclosure that the organisation has made. Okay. Now we're going to have a look at the Clarity Project. You may be aware that in 2004, the Auditing Practices Board in the UK adopted all of the international standards on auditing. From 2004 through to 2008, there was a moratorium on any new standards being issued other than any amendments due to changes in legislation. During that period from 2004 to 2008, the International Auditing Standards Board undertook something called the Clarity Project. The Clarity Project reported at the end of 2008. And the European Union have agreed to adopt those new clarified international standards on auditing now that it's been completed. During this Clarity Project, the Auditing Practices Board in the UK had a significant input. We were able to contribute towards the development of the clarified international standards on auditing. Now, the project on clarification included the following four objectives. First of all, that each ISA, international standard on auditing, had an objective, a clear objective for each ISA. Secondly, that there was a separate requirements section and application section. Thirdly, there was a clarification in the ISAs so that the work that the auditor had to do was prefaced by the word shall rather than the word should. Historically, it wasn't clear in the old ISAs which work the auditor had to do and which work the auditor could do. And lastly, there was an elimination of other ambiguities in the language used in the ISAs so that, again, it should be clear now which work is mandatory for the auditor and which work the auditor has a choice over. These new ISAs are now issued. They're now out. And the UK has adopted the new ISAs. Now, careful with this date. It's adopted the new ISAs from the 10th of December 2010. That's the 10th of December 2010. And that means that the current ISAs that we have are still in issue. So these clarified ISAs don't apply until after the 10th of December 2010. Something else to note about these new ISAs is that, first of all, we've still preserved our grey shaded boxes. So what I was talking about before, where the UK has its own version of the International Standards on Auditing, where it puts its own grey shaded boxes for items that are required in the UK only, those still exist. And secondly, what we've also done is we've also kept our ISA 700. Now, that's the ISA on audit reporting. Our ISA on audit reporting is different to the international ISA on audit reporting, but it's very, very similar. First of all, there are two brand new standards that have come out of the Clarity Project. The first one is ISA number 265, and that's called Reporting Deficiencies in Internal Controls. And secondly, there's ISA 450, Evaluation of Misstatements Identified in Audit. So that's two new ISAs that have come out of the Clarity Project. There are also 12 amended standards that have come out of the Clarity Project. The three most significant amendments are thought to be ISA 540 on fair value and accounting estimates, ISA 550 on related parties, and ISA 600 on groups, including component auditors. And you can go away and have a look at those three as your start point to having a look through the amended ISAs. Okay, well, that's the end of our podcast on recent changes to audit standards. I hope you've enjoyed listening. My name is Steve Carlisle. Thank you very much and goodbye.